This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the brand new edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper reporter.
This week, former Leeds, Nottingham Forest and Southampton midfielder David Pratton reveals how he made the leap from player to pundit to the main presenter of Sky's EFL coverage.
The phone line was breaking up in the car, so all I heard in the car was, can you come and do a Checkatrade game? And yeah, I was like, no worries, give us a bell back. But he kept saying it, he said about three or four times, thinking, yes, I can do it, it's absolutely fine, but I'm not busy. But no, we wanted to present it. So I was like, wow, that's amazing. So I said, yeah, definitely.
Crook tells us why Claude Puel's sacking vindicates his controversial comment piece at the very start of the Frenchman's tenure.
And what really went on between Maurizio Sarri and Kepa Arrizabalaga on the touchline at Wembley.
It's all on this week's edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast.
Shots on a Friday.
Back of the net.
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Sam will also be testing our knowledge on the origins of famous footballing phrases. It's the language of love. And don't forget, you can download any previous podcast you may have missed via the website. It's afcgeeks.com. How are you guys?
Yeah, not too bad, actually. I had a heart-stopping day yesterday. I was trying to juggle doing the Dancing on Ice commentary and watch a penalty shootout at the same time and tweet about both. It was multitasking at its very best.
Sensational stuff. Do you know what I love this week? I did three games in two days over the weekend. I've got two Premier League matches to come midweek. I love busy midweeks in the Premier League. I think it's fantastic and there should be more.
I love it. All being well, I'm on for all four leagues, covering them in the space of a week. Because I did League Two on Tuesday night, the glamour of Cheltenham Town against Cambridge. Then on Friday night, I did Cardiff City against Watford. Saturday, I did League One, which is Bristol Rovers against Sunderland. And I should be at Bristol City against Birmingham tomorrow night. So I don't think I've ever done it, but for the first time, all four leagues in a week.
Impressive. I'll be interesting to see your mileage claim after that.
It's quite astronomical.
It'd be more astronomical if Crook was doing it for you.
Well, there was certainly no shortage of talking points from this weekend. Let's try and make some sense of it all in the weekend in numbers. Manchester City remain on course for a possible quadruple after seeing off Chelsea on penalties in the Carabao Cup final. The Premier League champions have now won each of their last six shootouts.
Liverpool's 0-0 draw at Manchester United means the league leaders have now dropped 8 points from their last seven matches after giving up only six in their first 20.
Under pressure. David De Gea's 100th Premier League clean sheet also saw United avoid an unwanted record of conceding in seven successive home games for the first time since 1972.
Gerard Deulofeu's, I really struggle to say his name, treble in Watford's 5-1 trouncing of Cardiff makes the Spaniard only the third player to score a Premier League hat-trick on a Friday after Dean Windass and Thierry Henry.
Ooh. Huddersfield were beaten again, going down 2-0 at Newcastle. They've scored fewer goals and lost more games than any of the other 98 clubs in Europe's top five major leagues.
And Claude Puel was sacked by Leicester after their 4-1 defeat at home to Crystal Palace. The Foxes have now managed just five home wins in 12 months.
The Geek Sheet, this week in numbers.
Well, no wonder the natives were restless then. We will be talking a bit more about Claude Puel later in the podcast, but only one place to start, and that is at Wembley and those extraordinary scenes between Maurizio Sarri and Kepa Arrizabalaga. Sam, what on earth was that all about? Because they've come out and said different things, but we all saw what happened on the pitch.
Yeah, well, they were always going to come out and come up with a reason for why they behaved that way, because it was a diplomatic nightmare. And it was, in terms of the way that it made the club and the structure look, it looked awful. I mean, he looked like a man out of control, Maurizio Sarri, in a major cup final, in a game which was possibly, and possibly still is, going to be a defining one in his Chelsea career. I've spoken to a few people at Chelsea, absolutely astounded by what has happened. People that have been there for 22 years cannot believe. In fact, someone said to me, I thought there was going to be one day in 2019 when Maurizio Sarri actually came out with a bit of credit. Because, let's be honest, Chelsea played very, very well in the game. Alex and I had a conversation at the weekend on Saturday night, and I said to him, I said, Crook, I've got a sneaky feeling. I've got a sneaky feeling that they'll nick something, they'll get something, they'll play in a certain way on Sunday and come away with something. And he said to me, I can't wait to mention that on the podcast when you get thrashed 5-0. They applied themselves very, very well in that match, and the system was better because Hazard was relieved of defensive duties in effect, and he was playing in that false nine of position. Actually, he did a bit more than you would expect. He played very, very well in the game. Hudson-Odoi and Ruben Loftus-Cheek coming off the bench and doing brilliantly for Chelsea. And that's, you know, that shouldn't be taken lightly, two academy graduates starring in a cup final. But it all went wrong when Ariza Balaga faked that he was injured when he wasn't injured. He has had an injury. He's had a hamstring injury. And then he decided to tell everyone he had cramp. But he was doing what Sergio Romero did 7 days previous, which was taking the sting out of a game. Now,
time-wasting, essentially.
Essentially, yeah. And he hasn't communicated that to the manager properly. There was a bit of embarrassment. He can't come out and say that I was faking an injury because that would be, you know, not very ethical, really. He then wants to argue the fact that he's actually fine and he can be a goalkeeper for the penalty shootout. Nothing John Moss can do about it. He should have come off. Someone else should have intervened, really, one of the captains. I mean, the fact that Cesar Azpilicueta says afterwards, it's nothing to do with me, is, wow. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it just really sort of gives you a very clear picture of where things are at Chelsea. I don't think we should necessarily decry Maurizio Sarri. He started brilliantly. Things obviously haven't worked out since October, November, when everyone started to realise how to nullify Chelsea, and he hasn't changed it. He did change it, actually, slightly for the game on Sunday. But things have gone terribly wrong, and they've lost a lot of big games recently. I don't think he's very good at projecting what his long-term thoughts are, not only to the players. Yeah, sure, go for it.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I've seen some footage of the two team talks before the penalties. Has anyone else seen this, where Pep is right in the middle and orchestrating what he's saying, what's going to happen to the group, filling them with confidence? And there is another clip, the footage, it was just cutting to Sarri with his players. He's in the huddle and he is speaking and projecting, but David Luiz is next to him. And it's almost like Sarri doesn't have that much authority, just from looking for those sort of few seconds.
I think it's clear that there was a huddle, actually, that had already started and he wasn't a part of it just before the penalty shootout, the one that you're talking about. It was very late for him actually to get involved in that. They'd already started.
He was probably looking for his lighter, wouldn't he, at that stage?
But I go back to the thing about projecting that authority and projecting that plan. If you hire Maurizio Sarri, you've obviously decided on a long-term plan and you're going to invest in his football. So you have to move towards a completely different style of play. It goes right back to the start of the season when they'd failed to sack Antonio Conte early enough in order to get Sarri in and start working on the change of system within decent time going into the new season. After you've decided you're going to appoint Maurizio Sarri, you've got to back him. You've got to back him in terms of the transfers, but you've also got to back him in terms of patience, because, as he mentioned, there's going to be a long periods where things aren't going to go right, because what he's doing is he's playing one style of football that needs to be perfected. In order to get that right and be dazzling and amazing, he needs to do it all season, he feels, without changing. So he needs to school the players in that philosophy. Ultimately, what you really need to do is you need to school the players in that philosophy, change the way that Chelsea play out from the back and progress up the pitch, because we've seen in recent games that when they do that, it sometimes is brilliant. The problem is they're not scoring enough goals. So what you have to do is do that for a certain amount of time, and when things don't work, you have to change slightly. So you have to put on a striker to try and win a game. You have to change the dynamic of the makeup of the team to win a game. They haven't been doing that. So you start to lose the fans, you start to lose the players, and ultimately the media starts circling around you, and all of a sudden there's a massive disaster once again. So in terms of the way he has managed the situation himself, he would have had to, I think, communicate a lot better, because this transition of styles could quite easily have been done, but it has to be presented in a palatable way for all of those three stakeholders in order for you to get away with it.
I think you're being remarkably kind on Aretha Belaga here. Mm. You seem to be talking a lot about Sarri and the implications of his actions, but what about the goalkeeper himself? Now, I should make a disclaimer and say that I was once playing Sunday morning football for the Sirloin of Beef, my local pub, and I did tell my manager to F off when he tried to take me off and stayed on the pitch. It's not something I'm proud of. Yeah, I did apologise afterwards, slightly, more than Kepa has done.
Yeah. No. Kepa's come out and he's given a statement on his Instagram.
He had a statement, yeah.
I mean, it's not really an apology, is it? And the reason that Kepa's not been hung out to dry, not by Chelsea, not by you, Sam, if you don't mind me saying so, is because that dressing room is rotten to the core. These players have already seen off two managers. They know it doesn't matter what the manager says or does, or if they ignore his instructions, because they have the ability to get him out the door. They've proved it already. In fact, I've got it on very good authority that had they been well beaten on Sunday, as probably we all expected, he would have been gone today. As it is, this is no more than a stay of execution. He will lose his job. He knows that. Abramovich knows that. The players know that. And until Abramovich starts to stand up to these players, these massive egos, nothing is going to change at Chelsea. We're going to see history repeated time and time again. It's a shambles.
I think you're wrong about the saying that it's rotten in the dressing room. It isn't rotten in the dressing room because there's not big enough characters in that dressing room. We all know that he was a massive defeat away from getting the boot today. And we still don't know whether or not that's going to happen or not yet. If it doesn't happen today, it probably will happen on Thursday if they lose to Tottenham Hotspur. The issue is, as you have suggested here, there is a long-term absence of philosophy. So the idea of appointing Maurizio Sarri to try and change that philosophy was a good idea. The problem is that they've done it in a half-baked way. I haven't let Aretha Belaga off the hook. I just have concentrated on the other issues because I think there's a whole lot of other issues and this is just the culmination of them. I think it's ridiculous that he refused to come off. I think it's ridiculous that if he really had cramp, that's ridiculous. What is he doing? If he didn't have cramp, why is he making up an injury and not communicating it properly to the bench? And once he's told that he's coming off, he goes off. I'd have made the change anyway. Caballero's a fantastic goalkeeper when it comes to penalty shootouts. He's got a brilliant record. He's not a great goalkeeper anymore, but he's definitely a very good penalty stopper. I'd have made that change anyway. And if they decided to do that, then so be it. Get off the pitch. Why nobody else has decided to go over to him and say, "Oi, excuse me, you've been told to go off the pitch. Go off the pitch." I don't know. I don't get that. But it is a long-term culture. The Chelsea players, everybody believes that they're only 6-7 games away from the manager leaving.
Can I just say as well on that, how difficult that must have been for Maurizio Sarri? I know, I agree that Kepa definitely, he should have left the pitch. You know, that's absolutely insane, not doing what your manager tells you. That's the purpose of a manager. And it's quite clear that a lot of respect has gone. They can come out and say what they want after, but everyone could see those pictures. But also for Sarri to sort of stand there and be undermined like that in front of everyone, it's excruciating almost to watch. Neil Warnock said this morning, I did the Cardiff presser, and I said, "Has that ever happened to you?" He said, "No, never." He said, "But I don't want to say too much on it because you don't know about the communication and the language barrier and things like that. But I'd say it's pretty obvious that if the substitute goalkeeper is there, it's you that's going off." But I do feel for Sarri.
I do feel for Sarri to a point, but I don't think he helped himself. His reaction was extreme and uncontrolled.
Oh, bizarre.
He decided to have a meltdown on the touchline after not stamping his authority. So he could have stood there, put the ball up and insisted that goalkeeper came off and waited until that goalkeeper came off. But he didn't do that. He just had a meltdown and then decided to walk down the tunnel. And you can't do that.
And then he turned around. It's when he got there.
Visibly,
like, oh, no, I better not go.
He's sending a message to everybody that he is out of control and he has been beaten in a game of chicken by one of his players.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's absolutely unbelievable. We did a poll last night when I was on Sky, and I think we had like over 80,000 votes. 89% of people saying that Sarri should have made Kepa come off the pitch. And I was thinking to myself, how can he make him? But it's that simple, like you say, Sam. Just put his number up. But yeah, as the human element, I do feel sorry for Sarri and how he lost his temper in that way in front of everyone. But then again, I look back and think about how he's insisted on playing Jorginho in that position instead of Kante, and all the other things that he's perhaps kills been quite him as well. Stubbon,
you know,
about.
The fact that Jorginho takes the first penalty and misses it. I mean, you know, that's just like another nail in Sarri's coffin, which we don't want to see. We don't want to see. I think everybody would like to see anybody who supports Chelsea or is involved in Chelsea or a good, healthy Premier League would want to see a manager now come in and sort of take over and have a longer-term philosophy there. But, you know...
Won't happen with that dressing room until you get the bad eggs out and make it clear who's in charge. It isn't going to happen.
I don't think there's bad eggs in the dressing room. I just think that there isn't a situation...
They took a season off after winning the title.
But half those players have left now. It's a completely different group now. If you're talking about Oscar and Fabregas and players like that...
Hazard didn't cover himself in glory that season either.
I totally agree with you. But you're talking about players that have now left the club. It's a completely different dressing room. The other issue is that, and I was speaking to an assistant manager of a professional club last night who said to me, I said, look, what would you have done in that situation? And he said, whatever happens, that player comes off. Mm. That's it. Mm. That player has to come off. Because once I've made that decision, if I then go back on it, then there is a serious undermining of my authority within the group. And sadly, I think that is going to be what we take away from this.
They'll be laughing at him in the changing room at Cobham today. They will be laughing at their manager.
Oh, so sad. So sad. All a complete mess. So did Kepa break any official rules by refusing to come off once the kit man had handed the slip of paper to the fourth official?
No, this is interesting because I heard Stuart Pearce debating it on TalkSport this morning. There's nothing in law that suggests that once that slip of paper has been handed in, the player has to come off. So therefore, John Moss did everything right, really. Went over, sought clarification, wasn't at liberty to force Kepa to come off. That wasn't his responsibility. I do know that John Moss has told people privately he's not witnessed anything like that in 2 decades worth of officiating. But in terms of the rules, he applied them correctly.
It's interesting. Neil Warnock said he's been very critical of John Moss before, but he thought he handled it brilliantly when I spoke to him earlier. Mm. Yeah. Right, this is enough hate. Let's have some love. Language of love, please, Sam. What have we got this week?
Okay, so it's the latest in our etymology series, where do football words come from? We mentioned this a lot in football matches. Wilfried Zaha and James Maddison displayed them during the match that I was at this weekend. The two matches on Sunday, I don't think, produced too many incidents like this. But nutmegs, where you push the ball through the legs of an opponent. Where does that come from? Any ideas?
Just before we go on to where it comes from, I used to do a nutmeg when I was really little, learning to play football in my back garden with my brother's friend. And I used to do the nutmeg, but forget to go around the other side to get the ball. It just made me think of that. And I used to say to him, but why is it called a nutmeg? And he's like, oh, I don't know.
Did you used to shout nuts when you did it?
Yeah, but it wasn't complete nuts, was it? And the fact that we shout nuts makes me think, is it something to do with male anatomy?
Mm.
That's like as far as I'm going with that one.
Okay. Crook, any ideas?
No, I don't think it's that. I got a feeling it might be something to do with industry.
Do you? Okay, all right. Well, we'll come back to it a little bit later on. We will reveal all before the end of the pod.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It's the part of the pod where we welcome a special guest from the world of sports broadcasting. This week, a man who could once lay claim to having the best hair in the Premier League and now anchors Sky's Football League coverage. We sent Michelle to quiz David Prutton before his latest EFL Matters show.
Welcome along. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I hear you're a fan of Sam Matterface and Crook, not me.
Of all three of you. I thought it was an empty gesture when Crook asked me to come on ages ago. Subsequently, duped me into telling him about Danny Higginbottom not picking up on set pieces information back on track. And then listened to it back and thought, that made it sound like I just thought Danny's thick. And he's quite obviously not.
You made this transition from being a professional footballer, was it almost instant in becoming a broadcaster? Because you did Soccer Saturday for a while, didn't
I did.
You?
Stop playing wasn't a choice. I had nowhere left to go and play football. There was nothing on the cards. You're in a position where you go into the off season and you're not heard anything, and you have an agent and you don't earn anything off him. And then you get to the stage of the off season, June, July time, when everyone's going back for pre season. Mm. You need to make sure that you can do something of gainful employment. So I chased up a contact here called David Wade, who's since who's since moved over to work in Japan.
And you drove him that far away?
I did. He spent 3 years with me and went all the way over there. And then Peter Beager, who's working here at the time, again, very, very instrumental at the start, very helpful, pushed me a lot. And they were good as gold. So that I kind of sent an email to Wadey saying if there's any opportunities to do more of kind of games that we've done, I'd like to get involved. And it kind of progressed from there, really. And the fact, and as it kind of developed and you relaxed a bit more and you weren't overly terrified about making a mistake, something that progressed from there was speaking to the managers and stuff, which I just thought was great fun, like post-match type stuff. And I've just listened to a recent one of yours where trying to pitch how to talk to a manager after you've watched their team play horrendously for an hour and a half, I thought was fun. And it,
but as a player, you probably have a better insight than, say, me, Crook or Sam going down to do post-match. Like, we know, I knew Steve McLaren last week was going to be proper annoyed that they haven't got that penalty. That Bristol City had the penalty in the last minute and they got the winner. So you know Steve McLaren is absolutely fuming. You've seen him in the tunnel, not very happy and saying a few choice words. And you have to decide what to say to him then. So how did your experience as a player help with things like post-match?
Well, like you said, I mean, you've got to be sensitive to know that it can be a delicate time. Sensitive in the sense of picking up what the vibe is, not sensitive to say, well, I'm just going to kind of go lightly on whoever you're going to talk to.
Because you still need to ask the questions.
Of course you do. Because
whether you're mate or not.
Otherwise there's no point doing it, is there? So hopefully from that point of view, and managers can be quite refreshingly honest. And I just thought, if you're talking about particular post-match interviews in particular, then the first kind of right out of the gate, the first question's got to be in a position where you don't put yourself on the back foot or you aggravate someone very quickly. And I'm sure, I mean, you'd have done hundreds by now, and the good thing is the more they see your face and the more they realise what you're here for and why you're here, they'll understand what it's about. And then you've got a rapport, and rapport is the best thing you can have.
Do you think, sort of going to interview these managers and sometimes players, that when you went to speak to them, were you aware that you needed to keep your relationship with them, but also you needed respect from your new employer? You didn't want to be down there being their best mate, but you needed to get the respect of the employer. So who sort of, if you had to think, okay, I've got to ask this guy if he's under pressure, would you do that?
Hopefully you'd say it in a way that was understanding. Because, I mean, because let's be honest, everyone that does it, pre-match, post-match, and pre-match is probably one of the more difficult ones. Not that I've done too many of those, but
it's hard to get stuff out of them, isn't it?
It is, because when you sat there watching the studios, it comes in, there's a lot of it which you take out the teams and the manager, you can use the same sentences they all want
cliches.
Before the game, everybody wants to win the game. Fingers crossed the players aren't crap, you know what I mean? It's hopefully things are going to go in the right way. But post-match, I think it's imperative that you do it that way. And it's and the thing is, you're asking them about when you're commentating, say, you're delivering a verdict or commentating on or asking them a question about a football match or a player. You're not saying, do you like this fella as a person? What do you think?
It's not personal.
Not at all, at all. And it's something, I know some of them can be quite blasé and how many times you've been stood there, oh, he's not doing it. I'm like, oh, well, great, thanks, I've been stood here for 45 minutes and you're not going to do it. It's part of the experience of what it is to be a fan. They want to know what the manager thinks, want to know what. It's like on-pitch interviews, which we've done games together where you've done it. Take that, the playoffs from last season, just the euphoria.
You were doing Soccer Saturday, doing the post-match, the pre-match, getting all that sort of, I guess, experience for you, coming outside the changing room and being in the tunnel and having that side of it. And then what was the point that you realised, or perhaps Sky realised, this guy would be a good presenter?
It was Sean Boyle, the producer here, that he'd rung me. This was 18 months, maybe 2 years ago. And the phone line was breaking up in the car, so all I heard in the car was, can you come and do a Checkatrade game? And I was like, no worries, give us a bell back. But he kept saying it, he said about 3 or 4 times. I'm thinking, yes, I can do it, it's absolutely fine, but I'm not busy. But no, we want you to present it. So I was like, wow, that's amazing. So I said, yeah, definitely get me involved in that. And then spoke to Simon Thomas, spoke to Scott Minto, spoke to Kelly Cates, that I've done a lot of work with on the Saturday shows, and to a person, all very open, all very magnanimous, all very patient and giving of the time. That's me. They're asking like probably the most basic of questions. People that I've worked with, I've always made sure that you just ask the right questions, really. And I mean, not so. Well, the question's a bad question is on if you don't ask it. And I was very open and honest with them to say, tell me what you like, tell me what you don't like, tell me what's good, bad, and different, and I'll try and do more of the good stuff and try and filter out the other stuff. And everybody that I've come across has been really giving and patient at the time. And it's all very incremental, slow little steps, isn't it? It's just little things. Talk slower, you know what I mean? Pronounce your word. Stupid things like that, because it's functional. You want to make sure that everything's as...
And you are, in the nicest way, very northern. You know, you've been around footballers all your life.
Yeah.
You would not speak like a broadcaster, let's be honest. You are not a broadcast trained.
No, we'd swear a lot more. there'd be a lot more idiotic content. That's a very good point. But I never perhaps thought of it that way. I always loved English and languages at school. I always loved talking to the media when I was playing. I always realised that it's a good way of, if you're not in the team, keeping yourself out there. If you're on the team, making sure the fans, that the most important people, know what's going on. So from that point, we're absolutely right. So then it becomes, what are the fundamentals of doing a programme? It's getting to where the producer wants you to go. It's covering the things that you and the producer have discussed. It's getting on air at the right time, it's getting off air at the right time, it's getting to a break at the right time. All things which, and they are very structured and formulaic, but that's especially in a corporation like this with many, many channels, you've got to make sure that type of stuff's right. And then after that, hopefully, you drip feed whatever makes you you, and everyone is different, and that's the different way that you play to your strengths, hopefully.
And what makes David Pratton then?
Wowzers. How long is this? I thoroughly enjoy the work, in inverted commas. The subject matter is absolutely in my bones. I can't remember a time when I didn't love football. And that's the little kid in me that used to kick around with 25 mates out the back of the house on a big green. That's always been there. I think from my perspective of playing it, I've seen some really good parts of it. I've seen the other side of it, which perhaps isn't the level of football that you dream of playing, but it's part of the whole experience. And yes, it's incredibly important, football, to a lot of people across the world, but it's the most, as a very wise person once said to me, it's the most important of the unimportant stuff. So yes, things are that 3 points on a Saturday, getting through to a cup final, all that stuff is absolutely imperative at that moment in time. There's still another game to come, there's still a game before, there's still a young lad at the infancy in his career, there's a fellow at the back end of his career, and you've got to realise that, without getting too deep about what football is, it covers the whole broad experience of human emotion, and I love that fact. And but like I said, the other side of it, it's a game that we love. So why you got into it? It's a game that you love.
Why aren't you on social media? Like, we all have Twitter accounts.
Yes, I think it's a wonderful platform for connectivity. I think from a work point of view, and maybe you could vouch for that, it opens up avenues and you get connections with it. That's a very good question. It might be something that I look at as things progress, but I've always kind of thought, as long as the people that
employ you are happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and exactly. And the other side of it is there's probably a cynic in me that would, I don't know, maybe sit down one day and think, right, I'm going to find someone that don't like me. And if I find someone within 10 seconds, I'll be like, damn, right, I've got to say something now. The tribalism in football will get on people's nerves. If you discuss a game and, God forbid, it sounded like you lent an opinion more to one team, I know that instantly offends everyone else. So the barometer of what is kind of acceptable and reasoned debate sometimes gets lost, I think, on social media. But that's, I mean, it's instant, it's quick fire. And I said, I listen to this podcast a lot. I really, really enjoy it. And what you'd said and what you discussed the other week about bits that you had, I just think it's a particular type of idiot that uses that to go after people just for the sake of being mean. Christ, there's enough ill will and awful people on the planet, isn't there, for it to be to turn into a debate about football. But I don't know, like I said,
I think you'd be great on it.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I do.
Fast forward 3 months when I've had a glass of wine and battered someone.
We'll get you on it. No, sorry.
Michelle Owen made me say this.
Were you happy with the age you retired at, and do you miss playing?
Don't miss playing at all.
Wow.
I was happy. When I look back, I'm more, probably more happy now than when. I mean, when it stops, you kind of, you think about just the brass tacks of it, about you're 32, and in any other form of career, you're probably
just
getting towards
out, really.
What, yeah, and then aiming towards what the sweet spot would be,
and
progressing. But I there's part of me, unless you get struck down with chronic injuries or very bad injury or anything, any tragedy kind of happens, I think a footballer's career ends up being what it always probably was going to be. I could have done better, I could have done a damn sight worse, so I look back on that, and I don't miss it. I mean, there's a certain part of it which you kind of look back and you think, if I looked at the clubs that I played for and remembered and kind of went through them, I mean, I just find utterly ridiculous that I can say that I played at Nottingham Forest.
And you almost not believe that it was you.
Yeah, it's like the analogy that I've used before is, you're not like Forrest Gump, you know, when he keeps popping up in the background of famous events. It's like playing for Leeds United, playing for Sheffield, massive clubs that I watched as a kid on TV. I kind of boiled down my attributes as a footballer to being able to run around a lot as I got older, being able to talk to referees slightly nicer through the benefit of experience, and hopefully making the players around me feel good, and giving the ball to better players to do better things with. And I think managers could trust me with that.
But if I said to you, okay, Pratt, next season, you're not presenting the EFL, but you'll be a pundit on the Premier League.
Well, that is a good point. I am hopefully self-aware enough to know that if I was sat there pontificating about the Premier League as a pundit, there'd be a certain element that watching going, oh my God, what on earth has the world come to? And I've got no qualms about that at all. You stick me in a room with people that haven't played, you could stand there as one of the only people that's played in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. That's your cachet. But I understand there's an infinite number of pundits that carry a hell of a more heft to their opinion than I have when it comes to the Premier League. But I can active out. Yeah, I enjoy discussing it. You give your opinion on it, and if you're pretty true to your opinion and you stick to what you know, then hopefully that's where your kind of credence comes in. But I love the presenting side of it. I absolutely love.
You know, I love the EFL. It's my bread and butter. Mm. Do you think there is people think the Premier League, yeah, that's the ultimate, and don't perhaps give EFL enough credit?
The majority of my footballing experience has been in the Football League. Mm. Doing, as you say, like even when we've done Saturday afternoon commentaries in the Premier League, it's, you can't come away from what it is, or how at times nowadays, how Hollywood it feels. You watch these players walk in, you watch these managers walk in, and there's a real glow to them. And that excitement for me will never go, because you go to these places, like I said, that you watched, you read about as a kid, Anfield, Old Trafford, places like that, which are part of the footballing fabric of this country. There was a great thing. There was a producer that used to work here. He was very blunt with his assessments, and I found him an endlessly fascinating fella. Because as we know, when you're watching a football match, yes, the in-betweens are all nice and tactical, and why is he doing this, and maybe even chat about that, and why do you know such and such is playing this way? That's great. Give us all the info you've got. Tell us what we don't know or can't say. But listening to the important moments, the bit where the emotion comes in, what comes out in that instant, I found fascinating. And there was a sliding scale about, oh, well, I mean, if Aguero's scoring the goal that wins them the Premier League, then, oh my God, take the roof off that place. I mean, shoot yourself into the stratosphere. If it's a Tuesday night and it's one of the games, I don't know, and a team that's kind of just fair to middling, then you've got to do it accordingly, because surely as a level-minded viewer or listener, you're suddenly going, well, hang on, it's not the winning the World Cup final. I don't support a team, so I'm not, even that one of people saying, oh, when you, what's the first result you look for? I don't.
I mean, but
in the sense of, more often than not on a Saturday, I'm sat next to Liam watching the results come in. So I'm looking at all of them at the same time. Yeah. So when it comes to talking about them later on, you halfway know what you're talking about. But it doesn't mean I'm more fond or less fond of anyone that I've been at, but it's from my point of view, and hopefully what comes across in this, as I've always tried to say, playing football, being a footballer, was an immense privilege, and I was very, very fortunate to do that. And I feel very privileged to be doing this because it's football and we sit and talk about it. And it's a hell of a lot less sweaty as sat down.
What an absolute legend Prats is. You'd never have thought I once saw him shove a referee during a Premier League game.
Which referee was it? Can you remember?
I can't remember. It wasn't quite De Canio and Paul Alcock, but he did get a 10-match ban.
He did? Prutton. Unbelievable.
It was against Arsenal. I remember that much.
I can't believe that's never been brought up. How did he get away with that and still become this wonderful broadcaster? And by the way, you're right about that.
And
the hair.
Why didn't I mention it?
Yeah, well,
I should have mentioned that.
You're going to have to chastise yourself about that. Mate, well, listen, the good news is that now we can get him back on another occasion, right? Because he is very good, David, and delighted that he came on. And do you know what? He's a very intelligent man, but he's also always desperate to get better and better and better. He's worked very, very hard, and he listens to this podcast, and he loves it. Yeah, and he sent me an email and asked me after we talked about having a rules document, layman's guide to the laws, and asked if he could have it. There you go. That's a pod win.
Absolutely. Yeah, top man. Still to come on this week's pod, we'll have our tales from the tunnel, including the demise of Claude Puel at Leicester.
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
Okay, we're going to talk about our tales from the tunnel. This week, Michelle has been to Cardiff and watched them thrashed by Watford 5-1. And Delafeu, did you manage to work out your pronunciation of that? Did you get your tongue around it on air?
I was actually working for Five Live on Friday night, so it was quite important that I could say Tiago Delafeu or Delafeu. Everyone says it differently, which is really annoying. What's your pronunciation on it, Sam?
Mine came from Roberto Martinez, who basically said, don't bother trying because you won't be able to get your tongue around it. Fair enough.
Wonderful.
Because he says it's Deulofeu. Delafeu. He says it very, very well. So he then just said, just say Delafeu. I went, okay, I'll stick with that.
I said a variation of those.
Well done. Covered all bases. I was at Crystal Palace's 4-1 victory away at Leicester, which led to Claude Puel getting the push from Leicester City. I don't think anybody was too surprised about that. The mutiny in the stands had been building over the last few weeks. Actually, I think he's almost a little bit hard done by because they're not that bad a team. Even watching them on Saturday, they lost 4-1. Ridiculous, because they were so much better than Crystal Palace. But they just cannot score goals. And he's devised this system which just doesn't bring the best out of Jamie Vardy. Nullifies Jamie Vardy, actually, and does the opposition's job for them. Some great performances away from home on the road against some of the big boys. Even some great performances against some of the big boys at home. And you look at Manchester City as a weather vane for that. But ultimately, just it's boring, isn't it? And I talked to some Crystal Palace fans and some Leicester fans before the game, and they were basically arguing over who was the most boring out of the two of them. And in the end, that argument was settled, wasn't it? And it's, I'm afraid, Leicester City.
I also had a bit of stick on Twitter in December because I said, Puel had got those results against a couple of the bigger clubs, and he was still getting stick off his fans for the way he was playing. Well, you know, as it's transpired, he's now gone and people are bored with his style of playing. But, you know, where can they expect to finish, really, this season?
Look, I think that this highlights the problem we have at Chelsea and other clubs as well. And Crook, I think you'll understand this. I think we've mentioned this on the pod before. Your job as a manager is now completely different. You're not a manager of a football club. You're the manager of the team and the way that the team is perceived by the media and the general public and your supporters. That's your job. Your job isn't to go out and sign players and look after the tea room and organise the transport to this or there or whatever and manage all of those, the scouting and all of the other things that Sir Alex Ferguson used to do or Matt Busby used to do or back in the day. Your job is to coach the team and be the front of house representative. And Maurizio Sarri, Jose Mourinho, Claude Puel are all bad front of house managers. They don't give a good impression about the club. And I think that it, undermines them.
I agree 100%. Michelle said she got stick for praising Claude Puel. I got stick from Leicester fans on the day he was appointed for an article, a comment piece that I wrote for The Sun. I called him bored Puel, which having had to endure him at Southampton for so long, I was well within my rights. Listen, it's never nice to see anyone lose their job, but this appointment was doomed from the start. I said as much in that comment piece that I'm going to put up on the Geeks Twitter page, AFC Geeks. I got a lot of stick when he won his first few games, but here we are 16 months later, and everything I said has come home to roost. I actually think Whispering Claude, another of my nicknames for him, is a very good tactical manager. He's proved that at Southampton and at Leicester.
And before in France.
Because what he can do is send a team out to frustrate and take a point or even wins against the biggest sides in the leagues. Mm-hmm. The likes of your Liverpools and your Chelsea's and your Manchester City's. But the football that he serves up is as dull as his press conferences.
Especially at home.
It alienates the fans. And I think he's a really poor man manager as well, who the players really struggle to warm to. We've seen that at Leicester with the likes of Jamie Vardy and Wes Morgan, another player I understand that he is isolated. At Southampton, he fell out with several senior players, Ryan Bertrand and Nathan Redmond, who's now thriving under Hasenhüttl amongst them. They found his training lengthy and dull, especially in the couple of days leading up to a game when players want it short and sharp. His training sessions went on too long. They weren't really too sure what message he was trying to put across. And I also know that at Southampton, they tried to media train him to help improve his PR, that front of house that you're talking about. He just wasn't buying into it. I think there's an arrogance about him as well, a refusal to adapt. And ultimately, these days, the way a manager conducts himself in the media is so important, where press conferences are beamed around the world, they're poured over on TV and radio. I don't think we're going to see him on these shores again.
He has just released a statement, actually, in which he says he really appreciates the willingness to learn and the work ethic of the Leicester City players.
Wow. I don't think they appreciate his willingness to learn, put it that way.
And I think you're right about the tactical nature of it. I mean, even some of the football that they played on Saturday was really good, but they had no one to put the ball in the net. And that was because the system was devised. Jamie Vardy loves spacing behind the defence. But if a team drop very deep, which they generally do when they go to the King Power now to stop that counter-attack, they haven't got a plan B of how to usurp that and how to find a way around it, which is a real issue. And he's fallen out with key players, and as you've mentioned, I think Jamie Vardy called him which didn't go down particularly well.
I know Mike Stowell quite well because I played football with his wife for quite a while, and he's lovely, and he's in interim charge now. But they've said, haven't they, or it's come out that they'd quite like someone to be an interim charge because the people they want are in jobs right now. So I'm just waiting for Sam Allardyce to roll up.
He's declared his interest. Neil Lennon has declared his interest as well.
David Moyes.
There you are.
The usual suspects. It would be nice to see... I would love to see...
Lee Johnson.
A manager... No, not Lee Johnson. Well, actually, it's that trend of thought. I would like to see a manager from the Championship or someone that's done very well in arguably the lower leagues given a chance now. Names that sort of spring to mind are Lee Johnson, actually. And, you know, I think Nigel Adkins is doing an amazing job at Hull.
Don't do that to us again either.
I'm just trying to think of other managers that spring to mind. But, you know, there are young English managers as well in the Championship, League One, League Two, that could be given a chance in time. This may sound way out there, but maybe not for now, but in a few years, someone like Mike Flynn, who's done such an amazing job at Newport, he keeps that club afloat in League Two. He's taken us an incredible cup run. In a few years, why not someone like him? Maybe not now. But what about Michael Appleton? What happened with him when he was at Leicester, Crook or Sam?
Well, he had some issues, actually. He was about to take over at Hibernian not so long ago, and for whatever reason, that didn't come off. Mike Flynn's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, he is a fantastic character. I met him for the first time last Saturday, and he came up to me and he said to me, "Sam, if they can't enjoy this, you'll never enjoy football ever again. You can't love football if you can't enjoy a day like this." And we were having a chat, and the chairman was telling me how he rings him sometimes at midnight with an idea, and he wants to, you know, just to just talk it through with someone, and he doesn't know anyone else who's up who would listen to him, so he rings the chairman and just comes off with a stream of consciousness about how he's going to approach the next game or whatever. So that's an interesting one. What will happen is they'll appoint an interim manager, probably someone like Neil Lennon, until the end of the season, then Brendan Rodgers will be in charge next season, I think.
I think the issue with someone like Mike Flynn is we touched on it before, football these days is all about perception. And if you're a Leicester City fan and you appoint Mike Flynn, he's on a loser before he starts, just because he's not a big enough name. And I hate that phrase, but that's why someone like Mike Flynn, the only way he's going to get a top job is like Eddie Howe did at Bournemouth, actually take a team into the Premier League.
Or do what Nathan Jones is doing. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't have thought Nathan Jones is in the running at the moment.
He's not doing so well at the moment.
It's a long-term project, that one at Stoke, and it's not going to. There's about three different managers players at that club. He's got to try and turn that around somehow. But it's a long-term project, that one, and I think he knows what he's doing, and I think he'll turn that around eventually if he's given time, which at that club I hope he probably will do.
Yeah, I did a commentary with Liam Lawrence yesterday, actually, who's a former Stoke player, still lives in Stoke. I'm not going to reveal it on the podcast, but the amount of money that Sado Berahino has been fined this season just for coming in late for training, it is mind-boggling, the lack of discipline that Berahino has shown. Honestly, you couldn't even hazard a guess, and you get nowhere close how much he's been fined.
Wow. £1 million.
And just is it £1 million?
Not quite that much.
Well, are you going to tell us or not?
£100,000.
That's only a couple of weeks' wage, isn't it?
For being late for training.
For being late, though, Sam. How many times has he been late?
Exactly.
Does he even go to training? Doesn't look like it, does it? Let's be honest.
Do you know what? Can I just say something about... But God, we are going off on so many tangents. But Berahino, I was at Stoke's training ground last season.
And I watched you.
Sam, it was when Mark Hughes was there. Actually, would that have been last season or the season before?
Was it last season?
No, he didn't. I'll tell you what he didn't hit, Sam. The back of the net. I watched him aim at an empty goal for about 5 minutes. And then they put the keepers on. And he must have had 20 shots and he scored like two.
Oh, dear.
So little confidence.
I saw you sunning yourself, by the way, at Bristol Rovers on Saturday. How was that?
I have been getting a tan and loving life. Do you know what? I walked the dog in the morning. I thought, no, it'd be cold there. So I put on my thermal trousers and had a thermal top of my bag and all my layers. And at Bristol Rovers, you climb up this ladder. You have to punch through like a skylight. So one of these dome skylights, you push it up over your head, haul yourself up the ladder. It's a bit like Exeter City last week, but instead of coming out on a wooden platform, you come out on a roof and then you wander through the roof. And it actually was just like a conservatory because it had corrugated plastic roof on top. And it was beautiful. I had a jumper on. So you can take your Premier League grounds, and I'll take my League One ground. And I was very toasty.
Good. I'm pleased for you. It looked very, very comfortable, I must say.
I wouldn't go as far as comfortable, Sam, but it was warm.
It was really warm at Bournemouth as well, actually. It's lovely to watch football at Bournemouth when the sun's out. It was quite hot in the tunnel afterwards, just because of how bad... I think both managers perceived the performance of Roger East. I think he's been a little bit hard done by, because even VAR wouldn't have sorted out a couple of those penalty decisions. But I said to Eddie Howe when we were preparing for interviews, a sort of quip, I said, oh, Roger East has just been given man of the match. And he said, f***ing hell, which is, unusual for Eddie, but I think that really sums up exactly what he thought of the referee's performance.
Yeah, indeed. Do you want the answer, by the way, to where the word nutmeg comes from?
Language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Yeah, was I right?
Were you right? What did you suggest it was? You said it was something to do with a man's male anatomy. Testicles.
No, you've just said that. I said male anatomy.
Right, okay. So there's a book written by Alex Leith over the moon, Brian. They're called The Language of Football. And he says that the nuts term, the idea of nutmeg, it refers to the testicles of the player whose legs the ball has been played through. And nutmeg is just a development from nuts. But that has recently, you'll be pleased to know, been swept aside by Peter Seddon, who has written a book called Football Talk. And he says that it comes from the duplicitous practice in the nutmeg trade. So I suppose, Crook, you were almost there with industry, sort of. It's to do with trade. He points out, in the 1870s, in which Victorian slang came to mean to be tricked or deceived, especially in a manner which makes the victim look foolish, nutmeg was used. So the verb to be nutmeg or to nutmeg was to trick or deceive someone. That sort of started to come into football parlance as football became popular in the 1920s and 30s. The word arose because of the sort of sharp practice used in nutmeg exports between America and England. Nutmeg's very valuable commodity, and then there was sort of like unscrupulous exporters, people like Crook, who would try and pull a fast one by mixing a good sort of helping of wooden replicas in the sacks that which were shipped to England. So to nutmeg someone sort of was like, you know, to cheat them out of something or make them look a little bit stupid, and that's where it came from.
Didn't I nutmeg you once, Sam?
I don't remember that, no. I remember you supposed to be playing at centre half or right back in a charity game at Fratton Park and playing nowhere in that position. You were the Kepa Arrizabalaga Balaga of the team. You just did what you wanted and left me very much exposed as a short centre half anyway, but you know, with you at right back, it was a disaster.
True story.
Sadly, we're out of time for another week, but like Chelsea's Carabao Cup hopes, all good things must come to an end. Crook wrote that especially for you, Sam. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handles are exactly the same, at AFC Geeks. Do join us again next week.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.